Thank you, Cynthia. As she said, my talk is Research Needs for Agriculture Under Elevated Carbon Dioxide. And let's see, what do I want to push here? And again, I'm Mary Beth Kirkham from Kansas State University. And water and carbon dioxide are the two most important compounds affecting plant growth. And we all know from our introductory botany textbooks that carbon dioxide joins with water in the presence of light and chlorophyll to form glucose, a sugar, and oxygen. And we also know that the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. It was first monitored carefully in 1958 by Charles Keeling, who made his measurements at Mauna Loa, Hawaii, and the South Pole. And at that time, the carbon dioxide concentration was 316 parts per million. The globally averaged carbon dioxide concentration last year was 389 parts per million, so it's increased 73 parts per million in the last 52 years for an average increase of 1.4 parts per million. When I told my colleague at Kansas State University, Dr. Kim Williams, who teaches the class on greenhouse management, that I was going to be giving this talk, she says, well, you have to tell about carbon dioxide use under controlled agricultural production. So this is what she told me. She had on her desk there a brand new textbook written by Paul Nelson, who was her former major professor at North Carolina State University. And he has written a textbook called Greenhouse Operation and Management. It's now in its seventh edition, and it's so new that it has a 2012 publication date. In this book, he tells that for over 100 years, carbon dioxide has been added to greenhouses to increase growth. The commonly injected levels of carbon dioxide into the greenhouses around the world today are between 900 and 1,200 parts per million. And carbon dioxide generators are sold to greenhouse growers and burn natural gas to produce the elevated carbon dioxide in the greenhouse atmospheres. Dr. Williams particularly pointed out this curve to me, which she teaches in her classes in greenhouse management. This is data that Dr. Nelson has in his book, and it comes from data that Dr. Gastra collected in the Netherlands in 1962. On the y-axis, we have photosynthesis, and on the x-axis, we have illuminance or light intensity. Then there are three curves. The lowest curve is for, and this is for cucumber grown at 20 or 30 degrees C at 0.03% carbon dioxide or 300 parts per million. The middle curve is for cucumber grown at 20 degrees C at 0.13% or 1,300 parts per million carbon dioxide. And the top curve is for cucumber grown at 30 degrees C and again at 1,300 parts per million carbon dioxide. And so my colleague said, if all conditions are optimal, if you have optimal light, optimal temperature, and optimal water, and these cucumbers were grown under optimal water, you increase the carbon dioxide concentration, you're going to get more growth. And greenhouse growers now routinely are increasing their atmospheric concentrations of CO2 between 2.5 and 3 times, which now is occurring in the atmosphere. I myself have just published a textbook. It's called Elevated Carbon Dioxide, Impacts on Soil and Plant-Water Relations. It's published by CRC Press, which is now part of the Taylor and Francis Group. And CRC Press is the old chemical rubber company. And I know we all are familiar with the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics that has been published by the chemical rubber company, now CRC Press, since 1913. And they have just published their 92nd edition, which came out in August of this year. My research needs follow from this textbook. The talk is going to focus on water. And I'm going to follow water through the soil-plant-atmosphere continuum, or the SPAC. And that's the way water normally moves from the soil into the plant, out into the atmosphere. All right, I'm first going to talk about elevated carbon dioxide in the soil. And because carbon dioxide can be elevated in the atmosphere above the soil, I'm then going to talk about elevated carbon dioxide in the air above the soil. Then I'm going to talk about elevated carbon dioxide in stomata, elevated carbon dioxide in evapotranspiration, and elevated carbon dioxide in water use efficiency. All right, let's first look at elevated carbon dioxide in the soil. The four soil physical factors that affect plant growth are water, aeration, temperature, and mechanical impedance, or bulk density. There's little information concerning elevated carbon dioxide in the soil and its effects on the four soil physical factors that affect plant growth. However, I did find a paper by Tackett and Pearson, who published their work in the Soil Science Society of America Proceedings in 1964, where they studied the interaction of elevated carbon dioxide in the soil and bulk density. And this figure shows their results, but before I explain the results, I'd like to tell about their experiment. They had columns of soil that they divided. In the top half of the column, they kept the soil at the control bulk density, which was 1.3 grams per centimeter cubed. In the lower half of the column, they then had increased the bulk density. They had the control bulk density of 1.3 grams per centimeter cubed, then 1.5, 1.6, and 1.7 grams per centimeter cubed. Then in the lower half, which they called their subsoil, they injected four different levels of carbon dioxide. They had the control level, 0.03% carbon dioxide, then 6%, 12%, and 24%. The plant was cotton. They did this work in Auburn, Alabama, Auburn University. And here we have on the y-axis the rate of root elongation of the cotton roots. And on the x-axis, we have the subsoil carbon dioxide concentration. For the first three concentrations, there wasn't much difference in the cotton root growth, but at the 24% carbon dioxide level, the root growth decreased for each level of bulk density, except at the highest level when carbon dioxide had no effect and bulk density was controlling the growth. But even at the 1.3% grams per centimeter cubed, the roots grew fairly well at 24% carbon dioxide. So from this, I ask, because elevated carbon dioxide in the soil and bulk density interact to control root growth, will tillage need to be increased? Note that the best root growth was at the lowest bulk density, and so we might have to increase tillage in order to have more root growth under elevated levels of carbon dioxide in the soil. There's little information on the interaction of elevated carbon dioxide with the other three soil physical factors that affect plant growth: water, aeration, temperature. Oxygen in the soil has been much studied, but not carbon dioxide. We know the minimum amount of oxygen in the soil essential for roots. We know that gases move in the soil due to diffusion, and diffusion of gases in the soil stops when the air-filled pore space is less than 10%. This has been shown by many experiments. And we know that there's 21% oxygen in the air, and if we multiply that by the 10% pore space, we get a minimum oxygen concentration of 2.1% that's necessary for root growth. We do not know the maximum concentration of carbon dioxide in the soil that allows plant growth. And we also have other questions that need to be answered about elevated carbon dioxide in the soil, and here are some of them. How is seed germination affected by elevated carbon dioxide in the soil? What volume of soil about a seed is critical for diffusion of carbon dioxide away from the root and oxygen toward it? Will row spacing need to be increased under elevated carbon dioxide in the soil? These are all questions that we need to answer. Now let's turn to elevated carbon dioxide in the air above the soil. And now I'd like to turn to some experiments that we did in the evapotranspiration laboratory to illustrate some data. The evapotranspiration laboratory at Kansas State University measured soil water content in a rangeland exposed to ambient and double carbon dioxide. And we did this in 1989 and 1990, and at that time no one had measured under field conditions the effect of elevated carbon dioxide in the soil on the soil water content. We grew these plants at field capacity and half field capacity. And here's our rangeland research site. The experiments were funded by the Department of Energy. And we can see, it's not very visible in this lighted room, but there are four chambers there where we grew our rangeland plants. And here are the results. I'm going to present data for June of each year. The top half of the figure shows June of 1989, and the lower half shows June of 1990. And on the x-axis, I have soil water content, and on the y-axis, I have depth. And we measured water content using neutron probes down to the 2-meter depth. And on the left-hand side is the high water treatment, and on the right side is the low water treatment, or the half field capacity. The open symbols are the ambient CO2, and the closed symbols are the elevated CO2. And we can see that under the elevated CO2, there was more water in the soil. Other data followed ours, and it has confirmed that soil with elevated carbon dioxide in the air above it has more water. And this is because stomata are closed by elevated CO2, transpiration is reduced, and so we have more water in the soil. However, where the soil is extremely dry, for example in deserts, there's no effect of elevated CO2, and this is probably because the stomata already are closed and there's essentially no transpiration. However, in the research that I did for my book, I could find no experiment in the literature showing that soil water is reduced under elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide. It's either elevated or stays the same. So extension agents are going to need to revise irrigation recommendations under elevated atmospheric CO2. We need studies of different crops and different soils to know when to irrigate in an augmented CO2 world. Now, I'm just going to say a very few words about elevated carbon dioxide and stomata. Elevated carbon dioxide concentrations stimulate stomatal closure. Lowered CO2 concentrations open stomata. However, the mechanism of the carbon dioxide response is unknown. Plant physiologists have been studying this for a long time, but they still do not know why elevated carbon dioxide closes stomata. Now I'm going to say, now turn to stomatal density. Some data show that elevated carbon dioxide reduces stomatal density, and these observations are based on several different lines of evidence. First of all, experiments that have been done with plants at different altitudes. If plants are grown at a high altitude, they have a lower carbon dioxide concentration than plants that are grown at a low altitude, say at a base of a mountain, where the carbon dioxide concentration is greater. There's also the fossil record. We have data that we know where what the carbon dioxide concentration was in past geological times, and then we have fossils from those times, and so we can count the stomata on the fossils and compare their stomatal density to the carbon dioxide concentration at that time. However, most of the data comes from herbarium specimens. We have herbarium specimens that were collected pre-industrial times, and now we have the same specimens that grow currently, and so we can compare the stomatal density pre-industrial times to stomatal density now. And I want to say, as an aside, we need herbarium specimens. They're important. We need to keep herbariums. They should not be abandoned for molecular biology research. I'm reading how some herbariums are being abandoned to make space for laboratories dealing with molecular biology. We need more studies of stomatal density from herbariums around the world, and so we need to keep these herbariums so we can compare what plants looked like in the past with what they look like now. Now I'd like to turn... I'm talking about agronomic plants in particular. Yes, agricultural plants. Evapotranspiration. Evapotranspiration is reduced under elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide. And again, in the research I did for my book, I could find no experimental study that shows that evapotranspiration is increased under elevated CO2. And this is because ET is reduced because stomata close and transpiration is reduced. All right, this leads to the fact that canopy temperature is increased when evapotranspiration is reduced. We have less transpirational cooling, so canopy temperature is increased. And again, I'd like to turn to the experiments that we did with our rangeland plants. And remember, we grew them with ambient and doubled the ambient CO2 concentration and at field capacity and half field capacity. And here are the data. And here on the left-hand side, I have the data for 1989. And on the right-hand side, I have the data for 1990. And on the y-axis is canopy temperature, and on the x-axis is day of the year. And here on the upper half of the figure is the high water treatment field capacity, and the lower half of the figure is half field capacity. And again, the closed symbols are the elevated CO2, and the open symbols are the ambient CO2. And we can see that under the elevated CO2, the canopy temperature was warmer, and the average canopy temperature increased from about 1 to 1.7 degrees C. So I again ask this question: how far away from a field does reduced transpirational cooling persist? And this made me think of a thesis done by Hartwell Allen. He's now working for the USDA in Gainesville, Florida, but he did his PhD work with Dr. Ed Lemon at Cornell University in 1973. And my father, who was a soil physicist, also knew Ed Lemon. And when my father found this 1973 thesis, he sent it to me right away. And in the thesis, you'll read that Dr. Allen used a line source to increase carbon dioxide under different canopies. He worked with soybeans and corn. And from these underground, under the canopy pipes, he ejected carbon dioxide. But most of the carbon dioxide applied rapidly dispersed. He had a very hard time to keep any of the carbon dioxide in the canopy. Even on a calm day, there was much mixing of the air. So we need experimental data. Warming of the air due to reduced transpiration or cooling may be measurable only right above a field, and because of dispersion and turbulence that occurs in the atmosphere, this elevated canopy temperature may be evident only a small distance above the canopy. All right, let's turn to water use efficiency. It's defined as water divided by water, biomass divided by water used. And under elevated carbon dioxide, we have more biomass. Remember our equation for photosynthesis. With elevated carbon dioxide, we have more glucose or more biomass. And water use is decreased because stomata close. So water use efficiency is increased. And the reciprocal of water use efficiency is water requirement. The water requirement is decreased under elevated CO2. And again, I want to turn to some data that we collected in the evapotranspiration laboratory to compare the water requirement of wheat and how it's changed over the past few years. We grew winter wheat for 3 years under elevated carbon dioxide. And again, we had two watering regimes, field capacity and half field capacity. And here are our chambers that we use to elevate the carbon dioxide. And the wheat here is shown in March, so it's just starting to green up. All right, here are our data for water requirement for the winter wheat. On the y-axis is water requirement, and on the x-axis is carbon dioxide concentration. And we have the high water level on the left side and the low water level on the right side. For the three different years, we grew the winter wheat, 1984-85, 85-86, 86-87, and our three different levels of carbon dioxide were, four levels of carbon dioxide were 330 parts per million, 485 parts per million, 660 parts per million, and 825 parts per million. And I'm going to compare the water use efficiency now with what we got comparing the water requirement between the ambient level and the first increment. And here's the calculation. So we're going to look at the increase in water use efficiency since 1984 or the reduction in water requirement using winter wheat as an example. The ambient carbon dioxide concentration in 1984 was 330 parts per million. And the first increment in 1984-85 was 485 parts per million. And that was 155 parts per million over the ambient. 485 minus 330 is 155. And when I did this calculation, which I have in my book, the carbon dioxide concentration in 2008 was 385 parts per million, and that was 55 parts per million more than the 330, or it was 35% of the way to that first increment. 55 over 155 is 35%. So doing a calculation, we can calculate that winter wheat now, 2008, is using 41 milliliters less water to produce a gram of grain than it was in 1984-85. And we could do a similar calculation for grain sorghum, which we also grew back in 1984. And here's our field site for grain sorghum, again with the chambers over the grain sorghum. And doing that calculation, we can calculate that sorghum now is using 43 milliliters less water to produce a gram of grain than in 1984. However, more information is needed. How much is water use efficiency of different crops increased for each increment in carbon dioxide increase? And I have a final comment. The book is only a beginning. We need more experiments with different crops and soils under elevated carbon dioxide. We need a handbook. And there have been handbooks published on biology. For example, this is a cover of a 1966 handbook that my father contributed data to. And what his data was in a table, he showed how hydraulic conductivity changes with soil type and depth. And so I ask, how does hydraulic conductivity change under elevated carbon dioxide for different soils? We need tables of data showing that. Yes, I know. You have a handbook, definitely. Very good. And so I have this book.
For sale.
for sale. And I recommend that you have that handbook, and I've read it, but what I'm talking about particularly are tables of data, where you can go to a crop, see the CO2 concentration, and then see exactly what's going to happen for water use efficiency or stomatal conductance or things like that. But yes, I highly recommend that book. Okay, another handbook was one that my co-major professor, Wilfred Gardner, was asked to contribute to when I was a student with him. And so he used some of my PhD data that showed how osmotic adjustment of barley changes under different levels of salinity. Again, a table. I'm talking about tables of data. And so I ask, how does osmotic adjustment change under elevated carbon dioxide for different plants? We have essentially no information on how osmotic potential or osmotic adjustment is changed under elevated carbon dioxide. All right, so I'm going to make a very brief summary of what I said today. We need more experiments to answer the following questions. How do the four soil physical factors that affect root growth, water, aeration, temperature, and mechanical impedance interact with elevated carbon dioxide in the soil to control crop growth? Because elevated carbon dioxide increases the soil water content, what are irrigation recommendations for different crops under elevated CO2? Why does elevated CO2 close stomata? How does elevated CO2 change stomatal density? How far away from a canopy is the increase in canopy temperature due to elevated CO2 measurable? And what is the increase in water use efficiency for different crops under elevated CO2? And my very final comment is to thank Cynthia and Daniel for giving me this opportunity, and I am very, very appreciative for the chance to say these comments. Thank you.
Questions, comments, discussion for Mary Beth. Yes.
Yeah.
What's the lab? Certainly we need something about that, right?
Yeah.
What we have to do on top of what you suggested?
Yeah. Well, extrapolating to the larger scale deals with some modeling work, and that is something that I have not done. And I focus on the experimental work, but certainly we need to extrapolate to the larger scale to do some understanding. And I don't know if Bruce Kimball is still, yeah, you're there. Bruce, you've been working with some of these issues like increased water drainage. Have you, in some of your work, extrapolated to some of the larger scale? I know I read your paper where you were saying that because we have more water in the soil, we're going to have to develop different concepts of groundwater and its increase and so on. Do you have?
I'm not saying that too much, but I'm going to go back. I was going to make a comment along that line.
Yeah.
Can you stand up, please?
Stand up. I also agree with her in terms of increasing CO2 goes up while the water use goes down and soil water content goes up. The comment I'm going to make, though, is that temperature is going to go up.
Yeah.
Along with the CO2.
Yeah.
And so I'll also do a salesman job here. See a paper when Jack Morgan is a senior author that just came out in Nature where we're showing some calculations, at least within a range of temperature increases, not too far out in the future, the increase in CO2 and temperature are about going to balance each other in terms of the water use, but eventually probably the temperature is going to overpower the CO2.
Right. And that's one point I want to make, and I made it the point at the very beginning and make the point in my book, I'm dealing only with water, and I'm only dealing with experiments. There was a comment before the break saying these are experiments that have been done under controlled conditions. And so when you get the interaction of temperature or these other factors, like going back to that curve by Gastra, you're going to have different things happening to plants. But I'm looking just at the water, and I really can't answer your question about extrapolating to larger areas. I'm an experimentalist, and I look in the literature, and I see large gaps in data. So I think that we do need much more experimental data, and then these data then can be applied by modelers like Cynthia and many of the people here to have a validation of some of their models.
Okay.
at some kind of a rate, say from 600 to 1200, something like that.
Yeah.
So how does the CO2 concentration of a arid landscape and under irrigation look like in comparison, say, to a pasture in the eastern US or something like that? Is it different? Is it the same? Like you said, somehow it mixes it readily. Does it mean we have the same CO2 concentration across the board in that field, let's say, as an example, US artists?
I'm not quite following you.
I think what you're saying is, do some of these relationships hold in different environments?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, these are all very definitely for the environment in which they've been collected. And we were working in Kansas for our environment. And so I don't know about pastures out in, well, I suppose Jack Morgan has done some of this work, but certainly it would be very different ones. And that's why I brought in the desert. The desert environment is very non-responsive to elevated CO2, at least for the plant-water relations. Oh, yes, definitely. If you're asking about the average carbon dioxide, it's globally the average is pretty much the same because it's tremendously mixed. And that's the difference between carbon dioxide and temperature. Temperature is a very local effect that we have maximum, minimum. And you can go out. I'm teaching a class on this now. You can go out and measure temperatures very specifically, and they'll vary, but the carbon dioxide concentration is exactly the same around the world. And when we were doing our work with the winter wheat, sorghum, and rangeland plants, we would go out and measure it, and it would be increasing each year, and it would be the same as any other place in the world that was measuring. Charles Keeling was measuring at Mauna Loa and the South Pole, but it'd be the same in Russia or wherever else because of the mixing of the air.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, carbon dioxide is the same. So we can look at the effects of elevated carbon dioxide, but when you look at the effects of temperature, it gets much more complicated. Okay.
Thank you, Mary Beth.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mary Beth.